Hey there. Before we get into the show, if you like the order of things, leave us a review on Apple Podcast or wherever you're listening. Welcome to The Order of Things. I'm your host, Alec, and my guest today is Alfie Bown. Whether or not you play video games, Alfie thinks you should care about them. They are supplanting film as the dominant form of pop culture and have a unique connection to contemporary politics. Alfie is author of books like Enjoying It, Candy Crush and Capitalism, In the Event of Laughter, Psychoanalysis, Literature and Comedy, and The PlayStation Dream World. When we spoke, he was in the middle of Operation Earnest Voice.
It's an art project, but also a kind of propaganda think tank. So the idea is to set up a kind of fake propaganda office that's like making propaganda for left-wing stuff. Like in the spirit of Cambridge Analytica and things like that. It's like a really bizarre thing to do, but I'm doing it for 4 days and it's really interesting.
Alfie is a lecturer at Royal Holloway University where he teaches media arts and digital activism. Today we talk about the relationship between technology, video games, and desire. Can you just briefly explain the title? What does PlayStation Dream World mean?
Well, I guess my view was that because game studies and discussions of games has like massively boomed, as you know, in recent years, and like most of the tools people use are like from existing disciplines, other kinds of disciplines,
like media studies, or
yeah. So you got people in from film studies who use the kind of toolkit of movies to understand video games. You've got people in literature studies who kind of use literary approaches to think about narratives and video games and things like that. And, you know, my view is that video games are incredibly different to all those other forms of media which existed before. You know, they're different to TV, film, literature in kind of vast different ways. So, you know, I was kind of playfully trying to suggest that video games are more like dreams than they are like films or books or TV shows. So it's kind of like...
And what do you mean they're more like dreams?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the kind of the dream thing... has two kind of, histories. One is the kind of psychoanalysis idea. So I tried to use kind of like Freud and later psychoanalytic understandings of dreams to kind of apply to video games. And the other thing is actually coming from the philosophy of Walter Benjamin, who also writes about dreams in this book called The Arcades Project. And it's, I think, mm-hmm. very interesting connection that like in the, we call video game places arcades, but arcades were initially these kind of 19th century glass structures which emerged in Paris. And, you know, Walter Benjamin discusses that when you go into these kind of big glass buildings, crystal palaces, world of commodities and pleasures and stuff, it's dreamlike. And the person wandering through the Parisian arcade in the 19th century is this kind of dreaming subject, dreaming individual who experiences their world around them as if in a dream. And my view is that it's not a coincidence that video games are also played in arcades, and that when we enter our phones and computers, PlayStation headsets, Xboxes, we are also entering this kind of dreamland of images and commodities, and we experience the game in this kind of half-awake, dreamlike state. And I tried to kind of use that to explore how video games kind of affect us, how we get pleasure from them, and what their politics are and things like that.
And you would say the dream world created by video games is inherently different than, say, a movie or television.
I think so. I think so. I think it's vastly different because it's sort of puts the mind and body of the player into it in a way that film and TV don't. You know, it's. I mean, of course, TV and film are not always consumed passively, but nevertheless, the video game puts the user to work in its own world in a way that other older forms of media don't. Just as when you're dreaming, you know, you appear to be in there and an active participant in the dream, and you make choices which you're partially responsible for, but which are also partially out of your control.
Right. We're the ones stealing the cars or shooting the people or...
Yeah.
Creating the portals or something like that.
It's not always up to us how we behave in those spaces, just as in video games. You're kind of inhabiting the dream of something else or of someone else or or something else when you play games. And yeah, I mean, I'm obviously kind of being playful with the concept. I know there's massive differences between dreaming and gaming, but it seemed right. to be a useful way of kind of thinking through some of the bizarre and weird pleasures and experiences that you get from gaming. And, you know, most gamers, I think, will instinctively feel there's some truth in that. Like when you turn your PlayStation off, or when you take off your VR headset, when you finally pull yourself away from your console or PC, you do have a kind of feeling of coming back to reality, which is kind of comparable with the feeling of waking up after an utterly bizarre dream and things like that. So I was trying to kind of capture this element of gaming, which is actually probably quite common to most regular gamers, I think.
And you characterize it as video games both kind of create desire, but also feed off of desire. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose this is like one of the more kind of controversial aspects. Like, I definitely, obviously, am not under the illusion that, like, you know, games make us want things and do things. I'm not. Some people kind of maybe misinterpreted my position, or maybe I was kind of careless and came across at certain points as if I was saying, well, you know, look, video games make us want to do things. They control our desires. You know, I'm definitely not part of that kind of older kind of baby boomer narrative, you know, where people said, oh, don't let kids play Grand Theft Auto because they'll go out and copy it or something. You know, I don't think they put nasty ideas into our heads.
Well, I want to talk about that a little bit more, because you had written an article in The Guardian that got celebrated by a lot of people and also a lot of flack from a lot of different kinds of people, some of which were very extreme alt-righty types. But you write, for instance, right-wing ideologies have been overrepresented and dominant throughout the history of video games. Although affected by context, video games have long focused on the expulsion of, quote, aliens, like Space Invaders to XCOM, fear of impure infection, Half-Life to Last of Us, border control, Missile Commander to Plants vs. Zombies, territory acquisition, Command and Conquer to Splatoon, empire building, Civilization to Tropico, Princess Recovery, Mario to Zelda, and Restoration of Natural Harmony, Sonic to Farmville. And I think that on this point about video games compelling us to do things, I think what a lot of people got out of it is playing Space Invaders is going to make us sort of right-wing xenophobes that are afraid of aliens.
Yeah, and obviously it isn't. Yeah, I mean, that part was actually, there's actually a Breitbart article about what a kind of moron I am, which quotes that. But, you know, that's also a kind of badge of honor for me to be, at least I pissed off the right people as well as some others.
Right. So I guess my question is, what specifically draws the line? Because even as I read this, and I read your book, and I love 95% of it, and I think I disagree with 5%, which is pretty standard, I would say. But it's easy to read, even from someone on the left, a kind of like Tipper Gore, rap music is making kids violent kind of message in here. So how do you sort of extricate yourself from that?
Yeah. I mean, look, this was an example of something kind of, partly my own lack of clarity and partly a kind of misinterpretation, I suppose, that you know, this really wasn't how I wanted it to come across. I'm absolutely pro games. I've been a gamer since, you know, I think my 7th birthday I got a Game Gear, and from then on I've barely not played games. I play every day, give it pretty much. And I'm a massive supporter of games. And the whole premise of the book is that games are the dominant form of popular culture now. You know, they have kind of 50% plus penetration rate worldwide. And whether you like it or not, they are the new, I think it was even since I wrote the book that that gaming has overtaken cinema as the biggest entertainment industry financially. So, you know, they are the future of entertainment. They're here whether you like it or not. I really was annoyed with myself for allowing it to come across like I was kind of anti-games or something. Right. The premise of the book really is to think about politics and games, and to suggest that you know, this new form of popular culture, which is fast taking over as the most important form of entertainment for the future, needs to be the left wing needs to become more critically engaged in the production and discussion of video games, because to my mind the left is underrepresented in the gamer space. Now that is actually quite controversial among gamers to make that claim, because a lot of people think of video games as, I mean, it's not uncommon for people on the right to think that video games are generally liberal and left-wing ideology,
which also seems completely wrong.
Yeah, which I think is wrong. I think there's a conception among on the right that you know, games are left-wing ideology, and that I think is wrong. And obviously when I sort of said that games were right-wing, obviously that riled up people on the right who think they're left-wing. The second group is the problem that a lot of game designers actually identify as being left-wing themselves, and they believe that because they're left-wing, the games they make are left-wing. I also think that's false. I think that because some people kind of responded to my arguments by saying, well, we did a survey, for example, of 100 game designers and 60 of them are Democrats, and that proves games are predominantly left-wing. No, this is completely wrong, and that's why I use psychoanalysis in the book to explore that the fact that you might consciously consider yourself a liberal, you can still produce a game which tends towards kind of conservative politics, and even if... So, and this can be very complex to unpick and to dig out. So I was trying to be provocative there, I guess, and say that, you know, despite these assumptions on the right and among people who create games, that this is a liberal space, I think that there's a noticeable gap in the gaming industry, and that most of the patterns that you see tend to favour a kind of right-wing or neoliberal or just liberal ideology rather than left-wing ideas. And I think the left should kind of start to inhabit the gamer space more directly, more passionately. And actually, I think that has started to happen over the last 5 years. And what I would think of as left-wing games have begun to emerge more and more.
Yeah, and I want to talk about this mixture of compelling our desires and also feeding off of our desires, because while I wouldn't say, and I don't think you're saying either, that Space Invaders are going to make us vote for Donald Trump, there certainly, if we even look at movies, there is a kind of like the art reflects the time. So in the 50s, you get a lot of alien others destroying human individuality, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And we can say that mirrors Cold War ideology and stuff like that. Now, I don't think anyone would say we shouldn't show that movie because it's going to turn us, make us go into a new Red Scare. But I mean, there is certainly something interesting in that. When you think about the major paradigms of games like first person shooters, which are usually like kill the terrorist or, you know, war games like beat the Nazis, stuff like that. There's a lot of that kind of stuff. And those are often the most popular games. Of course, you have other games like, I don't know, the Sims or Tetris or anything, which certainly I would say don't fit into there. But I guess, you know, talk about how video games can sort of compel the desire and feed off of it a little bit more, if you would.
Yeah, okay. So you know, I mean, I think like all culture, I mean, video games do kind of respond to what we already want. Of course they do. They don't emerge from a vacuum. They emerge out of political conditions and so on. But they also kind of proliferate and modify desires. It's much more kind of dialectical. It's not that video games are evil and they're warping our natural desires into a horrible future. It's more a case that there is no kind of natural desires. All desires are political, and those kind of desires produce video games. But video games don't just give us what we want. They also construct what we want. And that's a really important, that might seem like in the abstract not particularly important point to make. But, you know, let's take, for example, the example of dating games or relationship simulators.
A popular one, what is it, Daddy Dating Simulator?
Yeah, Daddy Dating. I mean, the ones I'm fascinated by is things like Super Seducer, which got banned from the UK PlayStation Store. I think you guys can still get it over there, which is basically a pickup artistry game. And then I've got a VR game called Summer Lesson, which is like one of the most creepiest things. It's a Japanese game where you basically play as an older kind of patriarchal guy who's like a tutor or a teacher of most of the young girls.
Interacts with.
You just kind of stroke their hair and they like call you sensei and bow to you and show you like their skimpy clothes and things. It's a really horrible kind of game. And of course, on the one hand, they are designed to respond to an already existing desire, right? So, you know, there are certain people out there in Japan and the US and UK who to whom that answers their kind of patriarchal, misogynist desires, right? You know, there's some interesting discussions of this on the ContraPoints YouTube channel, where she's kind of started to foray into commenting on games in, I think, really interesting ways. But they don't just, you know, respond to an already existing kind of patriarchal misogynistic desire. They also proliferate that and construct that as a desire which exists. And you know, young, it is quite possible some people would play that and those kind of games. I'm not saying in a sort of simple way that, well, you play Summer Lesson and then you suddenly turn into a kind of horrible seedy old man. It's not like that. It's just that they're part of a wider politics of desire, which presents that as a legitimate form of desire and proliferates that and presents relationships in this kind of gamified way as well, which all kinds of virtual dating apps tend to do. And yes, I think that, you know, dating simulators and the gamification of dating changes the future of relationships and the way in which people desire each other in society, as well as being a kind of response to it, right? So that's just one example, the dating games, but where there's a dialectical relationship between, you know, desire, which the game responds to, and the kind of effects of those games on desires. And I think all games would kind of broadly fit that. That's just, right. It's just that example kind of makes it kind of more crystal clear, but other games might more subtly engage the desire of the user. So it's absolutely not saying that, right, if you shoot Arabs in Call of Duty, you're going to become a pro-American, you're not going to suddenly start supporting American foreign policy in your life. It's not clear cut in this way, but it's like saying none of it's innocent. It also doesn't have no effect, right? And that's another connection to the concept of dreams. If you have a dream, I don't want to be like reveal my nasty dreams to you, but you know, you might have a dream where you do something you wouldn't usually do in real life. It doesn't mean that you're like going to suddenly become the person you were in your dream, but nevertheless, it might affect, you know, it's not completely innocent, you know, it still kind of has an effect on the individual. And yeah, if video games have that quality and they're political things produced by people with political agendas, then they have an influence on global politics, so just as film did, of course, you know, Hollywood and other forms of cinema did affect the political climate in the 60s and 70s. So it shouldn't be surprising to see that video games are set to do that for future generations, I think.
Well, let's talk about, you said the left wing needs their own games. I think this is a really interesting question because there's a game called Spec Ops The Line. I'm not sure if you're familiar, which is a shooter game where I think you're an American special, you're an American soldier in Dubai or Abu Dhabi. Do you recall that?
I'm not sure where it's set, but I do know what you're about to say, I think.
Yeah, Spec Ops The Line is a game that takes place. You're an American soldier in the Middle East. There's a commander that's gone rogue, and you have to kill this commander. But slowly throughout the game, you realize that you're dealing with some post-traumatic stress, and you've committed all these terrible war crimes. And it's interesting because you're the one, you know, you're shooting people, you're doing all these things, but then it flashes back to these things that you remember doing, shooting these people. And in fact, you were killing civilians. And I think there's a use of white phosphorus and all kinds of things like that. And also mirrors the plot of Heart of Darkness. That's sort of Heart of the Darkness set there. So I think that's like a really interesting example of a left-wing game. Although I will say I love that game, but the mechanics of it aren't great, and maybe I'm being nitpicky, but I think, you know, there's other left-wing games like Papers, Please, where you play an immigration officer deciding who gets into the country. You had sent me a game called Novi News, where you determine what gets published in the news, and it's kind of this commentary on corporate-controlled media and things like that. So do you think there's a fundamental problem with left-wing games being boring at all? Because not of Spec Ops The Line, but certainly when I look at games like Paper Please or Novi News, I'm like, oh, these aren't as fun as just, you know, dominating the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important question. And I think, there's one thing I think is relevant here as well, that like part of my, like a key aspect of what I'm trying to claim with regards to this kind of politics and gaming is that the narrative like level is only half or less than half of the game. So, you know, for example, in game studies, there's also this kind of term like called ludology, which is basically, I guess, put simply, the study of gameplay. people tend to become either narratologist or ludologist, meaning they are so they either discuss the narrative or they discuss the gameplay. I think it's both of those things are a little bit reductive, and you have to kind of think about the relationship between them. In order to define whether a game's left-wing or not, a lot of discussion surrounds the narrative only. For instance, people, when I made this claim that games don't tend to be left-wing, a lot of people responded with lists. There's a couple of like lists of left-wing games, basically the articles based like, this idiot Alfie Bowne said this, here's nine games which prove him wrong kind of thing. There's a couple of these out there.
Right.
And in almost every case, the game is only left-wing on the narrative level. So, I mean, my favourite example of this is Assassin's Creed. Okay, like the narrative laid over the top tends to be in support of oppressed classes, you know, things like that, right? But the mechanics of the game, the experience of playing it, are absolutely not. It's basically the same as many other kind of open world games. Like, I'm not saying that Assassin's Creed is right wing on the gameplay level at all. I'm just saying that it's only liberal at the level of story, not at the level of like actual the pleasures derived from playing it, the ideas of it. So there's a really important distinction, I think, when we start to categorize games. Okay, this one's left wing, this one's right wing. If you're going to do that, I mean, some people would say you shouldn't do that anyway. If you're going to do that, you need to think quite carefully about how you mean that. Are you talking on the narrative level, on the level of gameplay, on the level of the desires that the game seems to produce or respond to? And those are quite complicated things to kind of separate sometimes. So I think with Papers, Please, you've got a game which is like structurally and on the level of desire, quite left-wing. Its actual mechanics are very, very different to any existing games. I think that's why you found it boring, because you've been trained to derive pleasure in a different kind of gaming, you know. And I don't think it's because it's not as fun as running around shooting people. I think it's because fundamentally the mechanics are different to the ones in which you've been trained to take pleasure, or those things have developed. Like, the more I played Papers, Please, the more pleasure I started to get out of it. And I mean, I can think of some more examples. I think of really exciting games in that regard. Something like Dwarf Fortress, or Everything, PS4 game called Everything, which is really interesting, utterly bizarre mechanics. And, you know, these are like experimental on the level of gameplay. And yeah, I think we find them more boring at first because they don't tally with the way in which we've come to approach gaming. But I believe in time they will be just as fun as mowing people down in GTA with an AK-47.
You talked about ludology and narrative. I think there's an interesting concept called ludonarrative dissonance, which has come up. I guess these games are like BioShock is an example. And for people who are not familiar, it takes place in this like underwater leaky utopia. There's a villain who's kind of a stand in for John Galt from the Ayn Rand stuff. But, I don't remember the specifics of BioShock, but for instance, ludonarrative dissonance would be a dissonance between the narrative and the mechanics of the gameplay, where let's say you've got a game about free will and exerting your free will, but the game's mechanics only allow you to do a limited amount of things. There is a dissonance there.
Yes.
I don't know if you have anything to say about that. I just think it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be used really interestingly. Isn't the Spec Ops a nice example of that? Because it's the fact that you're complicit when you're doing the first person shooting, and then when the narrative reveals the aspects of PTSD, that throws that produces the experience of ludonarrative dissonance, where you've been doing something which is then kind of thrown out of kilter or whatever, and that can force the gamer to confront something. I think that's certainly one, it's one tactic. It's actually often used as a criticism of games, but actually it can be a very interesting thing for a game to produce, and I think that can serve progressive political purposes. It's sort of one way of doing that.
So I want to shift gears a little bit. In the intro of PlayStation Dream World, you say people often view algorithms and machines as non-ideological, that they simply execute a task or analyze something objectively, but you half seriously refer to the ideology of robots. What do you mean by that?
My sense here is that people kind of labor under the illusion often that the technology itself is apolitical. It's just a question of what we do with it, which determines the politics. you know, this is actually not specifically to do with gaming, but to do with the tech that's in development at the moment in general. Like, obviously, like, the kinds of technology which gets funded, the kinds of robots which receive financial backing, and the kinds of robots we decide to create are political things, right? So it's not that, oh, well, self-driving cars are here because of, you know, apolitical natural advancement of technology. Not at all. Self-driving cars are here because we decided that those were the robots we would fund and create. So when self-driving cars cause a problem for the job market and plunge us into a kind of horrible platform capitalism of some kind, that is not like, oh, well, what do we do? They're here to stay. It's like, no, the robots have an ideology which has been built into them through the processes which led to their creation. And I think, again, the left needs to think about this. So, you know, I guess what I say about the left needs to become critically involved in the production of games would extrapolate out to other kinds of technology.
On the topic of this technology, you write in a Guardian article that a variety of pop culture artifacts from Black Mirror to Blade Runner 2049 warn that the robot lovers of the future may do nothing more than narcissistically affirm the user. This, however, is less a prediction of the future than a description of where we already are. Can you explain that?
Okay. My cool example to explain this is a chatbot called Replica. Have you heard of that?
No, I have not.
Okay, it's an AI chatbot, and it's designed to be a friend, I guess. It's an AI friend. It's basically like a WhatsApp conversation with an AI. It's got an interesting history because the woman who built it lost her best friend and created this AI as a kind of memory of him to kind of replace the hole in her life through her lost friend.
Which is literally a Black Mirror episode.
Yeah, which is literally a Black Mirror episode. So again, you know, this is why I'm making that point, that this is actually something that's already here. But the technology, the algorithms that Replica is based on is that it only learns from you. So it essentially learns to be you and reflect yourself back to you. And yet it's under the guise of a friend. You know, I think we can see that pattern in online dating, for example, that the structures of most match group. I mean, there are some more interesting dating sites, but you know, most match group sites tend to focus on this kind of idea of the lover as a reflection of the self, and we can see the technology kind of reflecting that in examples like Replica. So you know, this idea that your best friend, your closest partner, is a kind of mirror or reflection of you, which is this kind of odd narcissism, is very much already here. And video games do play a role here too as well, and again, the dating simulators we mentioned, and kind of ideal avatars, things like that. This is quite interesting that this is kind of emerging, it goes across from online dating to actual technology. And then there's also the example of Trump.dating. Have you heard of that?
I have, but there is an interesting podcast about it. There's like a website where it will make a dating site for you. You pay them like a couple $1,000s and it will just create the website. So I think there was like Trump.dating and also NeverTrump.dating, and they had like the same users. And the reason is because they were collecting from the same, the company that launches these dating sites that they charge people for, amalgamate all the users into one actual thing. So it's a giant scam. Like when you're on Trump.dating, you're going to find users from Never Trump, but also like golfersmeet.com and, you know, furriesmeet.com and all the different things. But it is interesting that it was someone's idea to begin with.
Yeah, that's also a kind of, you're right, that's a scam, but there's also a sense that this kind of narcissistic matching of people with mirrors of themselves might have a kind of political angle somewhere as well, because you're not seeing Corbyn.dating.
Well, you are seeing someone tried to create, it was a Facebook group, I think, called OK Comrade. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, no, but I'm definitely going to look that up. That sounds really interesting.
It was a Facebook group and they were making a site and it was like under construction and it might still very well be. I think I would, certainly people on the right are looking for other people on the right. I think people on the left equally do. And it kind of reminds me of Alain Badiou's book on love, he kind of talks about our tendency to view love as kind of an act of consumption, where we're sort of checking off boxes like we would when selecting a refrigerator or something like that, that has all the features we need and stuff like that, which kind of destroys any ability for, you know, random chance or, but more importantly, I think to your point of narcissism, that we're looking for someone exactly like us. And I think you'd be hard pressed. I mean, I can speak more to this because of the people I know, but like, you know, my friend certainly wouldn't date a person who's a Trump supporter or like a xenophobe, or I think even in literal ways, people don't want to date outside of their income bracket.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm not saying that right-wing people do this and lefties don't. I'm saying that there's something inherently right-leaning about this logic. And I agree with Alain Badiou, and also with there's an interesting book by Srećko Horvat called The Radicality of Love, where he tries to respond to that and sort of say that what's needed in the relationship between the left and love is a kind of solidarity with otherness or something, you know. So that, you know, what we would need to do is, of course, we shouldn't create a Corbyn.dating or a comrade dating site. Instead, we would need a different set of algorithms which are much more open to possibilities of chance and, you know, cross identity solidarity instead of this kind of identity politics dating. I think that's a good point. And yeah, these. So it's not that. Yeah, we're doing this to ourselves on the left, but we could think about more interesting ways of reconceiving those things, I think.
Do you find there's a stigma in academia when talking about video games so extensively? Because it seems like there's not many people doing it.
There's not so many in the UK. You know, actually, I'm lucky. I'm writing now because I'm at Royal Holloway, University of London now. I've just been here 3 months. Loving it because next year we start a program called it's a BA and it's called Video Game Art and Design, and we'll have 50% coders who will teach our students how to write games, programming in Unity and so on, and then 50% is kind of philosophers, which is like that's the group I'm in, where we will like think about games as a critical object of study, you know, and how important they are and stuff. So I guess I'm lucky to be at one of the places where this is happening, and yeah, is there a stigma? I think most people, I think it probably was a couple of years ago when I started working on games about 2014, so only about 5 years ago. I think then, yeah, people were like, no, this is, what are you doing? This is like mindless compared to literature or film. But now I think, no, I think people like have actually, you know, come around to the awareness that, you know, whatever you think of them, they're here to stay, and that they're a very important piece of culture. And yeah, nowadays I'd say it's... yeah, it's completely changed. People are really up for video games as a serious thing and as a political thing as well, which has really changed. I mean, the idea that they're just a bit of fun and don't have politics tied closely to them is kind of gone, which is good, I think.
Was there any specific pushback that you remember when you were starting out? Any fun anecdotes of like a older department chair telling you what you were doing was not real philosophy?
Oh, yeah, I mean, when I told my PhD supervisors that I was going to drop literature and go to game studies, they all thought I was as mad. But actually, it was just at the time of Gamergate, you know. So, and I think that Gamergate, you know, for all its kind of ills, that does, you know, that marks the point at which people began to take gaming cultures seriously. It's interesting. I mean, and now you're seeing, you still see people saying it. I mean, like you see like game developers, like the, you know, like the Division 2, for example, which is that out yet? Not out yet, is it?
No, I've played the first one.
Yeah. And the guy who's, you know, this is like set in a dystopian Washington, D.C. about like broken America and so on. And then like the guy who made it, It's the Ubisoft guy, I've forgotten his name. He like, when he was asked about it, was like, no, this has nothing to do with politics whatsoever. It's like, how can you even think that? Like, one minute of... Like, even the trailer is, like, so deeply political. Like, but, yeah, so this is, like, still a ongoing assumption about games that needs to be kind of fought. But generally speaking, you know, this is now... I think it's now a very exciting aspect of academia and journalism. People get really riled up about it, as you've seen. You know, if you say something about video games and politics, people become very angry. Other people are very interested. You know, it really sets people on edge and gets people fighting and battling over these things. And I think that's because there's a general awareness that this is like damn important now.
Hmm. What do you make of the reaction to you? And I'll state that purposely vague.
Well, you know, some of it's the reaction to my book has been good, because I think it's a very short book, but still it's like if you read enough of it, you can see that where I'm coming from is decent. And I am, you know, but whereas some of the articles where, you know, it's just 700 words or something, it's easy to, I could totally understand why people just thought I was yet another journalist just saying games are bad in order to get myself an article published. You know, I totally get how it could come across that way. I think, you know, once people have realized that actually I am a gamer and have dedicated 5 years to the study of politics of games, people think, okay, actually in the context of that, these points make sense. I think people's reactions, you know, so on the one hand, I'm kind of apologizing, saying I understand how it came across and it's fine. On the other hand, I think people's reactions kind of do embody like the issue. Like, okay, so people were riled up on the right because they think it's absurd to say that video games have right-leaning biases inherent to them in certain cases. People in the liberal centre that I'm, like I mentioned, kind of what I would call the liberal Twitterati, you know, who kind of hounded me for it, because they think of themselves as left-wing and the games they make and the games they play as left-wing. Now, that's really where psychoanalysis is needed, to explore how a lot of the time the politics of the game is not, how it appears superficially, or it's not held in its narrative, or, you know, in other words, you can be a far left activist, but you can write a novel which is still, you know, conservative. It's quite possible for that to be the case. And so people's reactions to what I'd kind of said about that, I think kind of do point to this problem that people are unable to think of the unconscious elements of video games, which is probably, in my opinion, the unconscious aspects of gaming are the most important ones.
What's interesting is, in a little bit, you're going to read mean tweets about yourself because you've agreed to this. but as I was looking them up, what's interesting is me as someone who disagrees with you at times, but am looking for people complaining about you incessantly. I think the microcosm of this is someone saying like, oh, I guess playing video games makes you a Nazi, but in their profile or the name on their Twitter was like the okay hand sign, which has been, it's weird. It was invented as a, we're going to make up this nonsensical symbol and say it's associated with Nazis and then see like the media run off with it. But then Nazis started doing it in earnest to do it. So this person had the okay sign, and then I click on their profile, and they're calling like neo-Nazis attacking refugees like heroes and stuff like that. So they're laughing at you for calling video games right-wing and saying you're an idiot, but they themselves are literally celebrating Nazis. So similarly, there was a YouTube video I watched. It was like a reaction video to reading your article. And he's like, Gamergate's not misogynist, it was mostly women. And I'm not a Gamergate expert, but I'm fairly certain that's false, and accuses journalists of harassing gamers. And then just goes on to say a bunch of like, you know, terrible things.
Yeah, I mean, Gamergate might have started as a left-wing thing, but it was very misogynist and became kind of harnessed by those things. So yeah, and I mean, your description of that mirrors my kind of experience of it too. I think that a lot of the people who came out very angry were the right people. Like I mentioned, there's a Breitbart article about it. I also got kind of baited by a lot of people, like people on the right who pretended to like want to interview me, but when I researched them, they were doing it to kind of trick me into doing some kind of alt-right podcast or something.
Oh god.
And also there's 4chan boards about me and my arguments, which, you know, are just like vile, just like anti-Semitic and anti-feminist and just like hot, full of hatred and stuff. So, you know, I take some kind of comfort in having pissed off some of the right people. and you know, that's, I mean, I guess that's okay. I mean, it's not my aim to rile up people on the right, but, you know, I guess that's a kind of collateral damage of actually saying something that people might not want to hear or whatever. And that therefore there might be something in it. But I do think, yeah, I do think I also pissed off, as it were, as you could say, some of the wrong people who would be the kind of more liberal groups who might actually should be part of the future of building a more kind of progressive game world.
So if you're talking to a person who doesn't really play video games or hasn't played video games since they were a child, what are there any introductory kind of lefty games that you would recommend for someone who's not a mega gamer?
There's sort of so many various ways to approach that, but I think I think we've mentioned some. I like directly lefty games like Corbin Run, which is made by a company called Games for the Many, which is an actively left-wing game company which produces games for political content, which I think is fascinating. I think Papers, Please is a good example because it can be played by anyone with no actual gaming skills. Like, you don't need to even know how to use a controller to have a go at that. It's just a kind of, you know, it's kind of intuitive, just kind of clicking. You need to know how to use a mouse, but that's it. I actually wouldn't. As you've seen, I did try and kind of build a list of games which I think are working in the correct direction. But I wouldn't discourage anyone from. I don't want to be too prescriptive there. I don't think it's a case of saying, oh, you shouldn't play Call of Duty. You should play Papers, Please. I think it's a case of playing everything critically and just thinking about the fact that none of it's apolitical, and that there might be kind of absences. You know, I would like to see the left wing space grow. I think that would begin to change the pleasures and enjoyments of the gaming world. That's not me saying don't play this because it's, you know, Mario is about recovering princesses or whatever. You know, I wasn't saying that. Or don't play Plants vs. Zombies because it's about border control. It's not about saying that. It's saying that there are patterns which are built into the common structures of games. And we need to create alternative ones, as well as remaking games with the same kind of structural base. Have a go at Corbin Run and Papers, Please as an early example of what I think is a kind of undeveloped area of left-wing gaming, which is growing. But by no means am I saying you shouldn't play anything else.
So I think it's that time, Alfie. Some quick context for the listener. Alfie agreed to read some mean tweets about himself, so here it is. They're bad people, and I don't know if all of them are bad people. It seems like at least 90% of them are bad people that I don't want to personally promote their Twitter following. So yeah, just read away.
I'm ready. Okay, so here's the first one. That Alfie Bowen article is so stupid for so many reasons, and I've been trying not to waste any more thought on it than I already have, but Jesus fuck, that dude is stupid.
All right, next one.
This is fun. If you keep referring to Alfie Bowen's garbage in The Guardian as a legitimate citation for games cause real-world violence and mass shootings, just surrender your journalist degree immediately.
This is another one from the same person. This one is a notorious... I don't even know the degree of white supremacist he is or alt-right. I can't be bothered to separate them. But,
this stuff on Twitter is way softer than some of the stuff I saw on the Cham boards and stuff.
Oh, God.
A funny one. I can't remember what it is, but there was a funny tweet from the comedian called Alfie Brown. And someone had sent him a nasty tweet about what a bad journalist he was. And then he was like, no, that's not me. And then he also tweeted about me, calling me a soy boy or something else. but now I've actually bonded with comedian Alfie Brown over the issue on Twitter. So we're friends now. Here we go. Alfie Brown is a boring little taint who thinks his work as criticism of video games will alter the medium for millions of people as some sort of political delivery system. See, this one reminds me of an important point, because I actually did this refers to a newer article, actually, not the one I got most of the criticism for. This refers to a newer article in The Guardian. And this is really interesting, because a lot of people on the right were shocked, saying, this guy actually thinks games should be left-wing propaganda. You know, and they thought that was immoral of me to say, because there's an assumption that we should, that games shouldn't be too political. You know, this is why the Division 2 developer constantly denies that the game's political even when it is, because there's actually still an existing idea in games that they shouldn't be directly prescriptive politically. My point is not that they should be, but that they already are, whether you like it or not. So it's not, I'm not saying, look, games are apolitical, we should actually make directly political games. No, I'm saying games are directly political, and they always have been. It's a question of thinking about what that politics is and whether we would like to change it at all.
Hmm. All right.
Are there any more of these? These are fun.
Oh, yeah.
Farmville makes you a Nazi. Laughing icon. MSM goes full MSN.
This, by the way, is the person with the Nazi symbol, the little okay hand sign.
Pro-Sweden and freedom of speech. Femme and PC are cancer. Ultra right. Okay, so here I'm quite happy to be criticized by this geezer.
All right, now next up.
Gosh, you found a lot. You found a lot.
I'm thorough.
This one, is this satire? Please tell me this is satire. Yeah, that's the article I got the most criticism for.
All right, last one. Okay. And then I'll, yeah.
This is good, yeah. Start off your Monday with a fresh cup of coffee and a tasty plate of bullshit. Explore the mind of Alfie Baum, an individual capable of painting games like Horizon Zero Dawn, The Last of Us, and even Super Mario as fronts for alt-right ideologies. How did I not see it myself? See, this is funny. This guy can have it.
All right, Alfie, what are you... So now you're working on a game about love? Sorry, now you're working on a book about love?
Yeah, but as I say, so it's not like, you know, we mentioned in our chat both Badiou's book and Sreshko Horvat's book. It's not really in the line of though. I'm very interested in those guys' arguments, but it's not really in the line of that because I'm not trying to like theorize love. It's very specifically about new technologies. So, like, you know, as I said, smart condoms feature heavily. They're like bizarre.
Kind of. Is that like a Fitbit for your penis?
Yeah, basically. Yeah, you pop it on. And they were, interestingly, they were marketed as a kind of feminist thing in the early stages because it was like, okay, men are going to have to get good at sex now. But actually, it's obviously this kind of bro culture of like sexual prowess comparison and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm exploring the politics of new technologies of love. So sex robots, online dating algorithms, smart condoms, VR and AR relationships, maybe even VR porn and stuff like that, just to kind of think about how these kind of actual concrete new emergent technologies might like influence the sphere of love and relationships and friendships too.
What's the most outlandish sex tech you've seen?
Well, I'll tell you, a good one is this robot brothel opening in New York that's a kind of queer, and I totally agree with the logic of it. I think it's called Unicult, the place. They seem like absolute nutters to me, but I agree with the idea that basically they're saying that existing relationships with robots are misogynistic and patriarchal. Let's build a kind of queer feminist sex robot brothel. So it's interesting, and that's the reverse of the Icon, which is the smart condom. So I'd say those two are like kind of most bizarre and interesting things I've encountered. A Fitbit for your penis that allows you to compare your sexual prowess with your male friends on 4chan, and an alternative kind of sex robot brothel. And it is actually related to gaming. I'm calling the book something like gamifying love or something, because it's all about this kind of. So I'm still working on games and how relationships become kind of gamified, and also games which help with that process as well. So it's really interesting stuff. But I've been thinking about it for ages, and I'm not really getting anywhere fast, but
I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much. Where should people find you on the internet?
So I've rejoined Twitter if people want to send me some abuse. Luckily, I wasn't on Twitter during that period of where all these tweets came. So I was sort of So I think I'm at leftistgamer on Twitter, leftist_gamer. And yeah, that's probably the best way. And I can just be Googled as well.
All right, Alfie Baum, the author of PlayStation Dream World. Definitely check it out. Thank you so much, Alfie.
I really enjoyed it, Alec. That was fantastic. Cheers.
If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review wherever you're listening, iTunes, Google Play, wherever. Reach out on Twitter. We're at CritTheory, C-R-I-T, Theory. You can find links to Alfie's articles and books in the description. Until next time.